Welcome to Smart Healthcare Safety from ECRI, the most trusted voice in healthcare, committed to advancing effective, evidence-based care. I'm your host, Paul Anderson, and for more than 15 years, I've overseen our risk management membership programs here at ECRI. Tens of thousands of healthcare leaders rely on us as an independent, trusted authority to improve the safety, quality, and cost-effectiveness of care across all healthcare settings worldwide. You can learn more about our unique capabilities to improve outcomes at www.ecri.org. We often think of medical emergencies in the context of the emergency department, or as taking place outside of healthcare facilities entirely, where emergency medical services personnel are summoned to help. But medical emergencies can occur anywhere, including in office and clinic settings, and sometimes those emergencies involve medications. Our guest today is Dr. Kelly Schultz, a retired pediatrician with over 30 years of experience in both pediatric hospital medicine and primary care pediatrics. She has served in many capacities over those 30 years, including as a patient safety officer, as director of clinical informatics with significant experience in electronic health record implementation, and as director of simulation for a newborn resuscitation program. She has served as a consultant for the Institute for Safe Medication Practices for 17 years and as the medical director of ISMP for 3 years. Dr. Schultz, what are some medical, or maybe we should focus in on the medication-related emergencies that can happen in office practices? And what types of things in particular does ISMP see in these settings?
Well, first of all, Paul, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be able to talk about this. I think it's a timely topic. It's never going to go away from our world, even though, as you say, most of us think about hospital emergencies more than office emergencies. For the purposes of this conversation, I think it's maybe easiest to divide the emergencies into those that are medical emergencies, such as chest pain, respiratory emergencies like asthma attacks, seizures, minor injuries that people show up at office or outpatient settings to have dealt with, falls, those kinds of things. But then there's the category that you mentioned about the emergencies that are related to medications that are administered in an outpatient setting. And these are the things that ISMP hears about. For example, most offices are giving things like allergy shots. Some offices give antibiotics. And many offices, particularly our primary care offices where kids are seen, are giving vaccines on a regular basis. So these are the kinds of things that I think make the most sense for us to think about as we are concerned about the emergencies that occur outside of a hospital.
But Dr. Schultz, you know, you mentioned some of those emergencies dealing with, you know, administering, for instance, antibiotics or allergy shots, things like that. What can be some of the consequences of those emergencies? How do they manifest in the patient? How do we sort of see them show up?
You know, I think that in an office setting, most schedules are made in such a way that the visits are short. And so when a medication is delivered, oftentimes what happens is that the observation periods for those patients in an office setting isn't long enough to actually see the manifestations of things like an allergy or a response to an allergy shot or an allergic reaction to a medication, perhaps. Somebody starts to wheeze or have difficulty breathing. So when office schedules are made in such a way that offices are seeing sometimes 20 and 30 patients in a day, sometimes you just don't get the chance to see the outcome. And patients leave your setting and go off to do whatever it is that the rest of their day includes.
So that obviously is a significant challenge, right? Just that time that we have with the patient while they're there physically, you know, in the office setting. What other kind of challenges do these outpatient settings face when they're trying to respond to medication-related emergencies?
So it's a great question, Paul, and there are many issues that confront offices. The thing that I think we are all seeing all across healthcare, both as an inpatient and outpatient, is that we are seeing patients with higher acuity. Patients are sicker when they get to us. Oftentimes this is related to not having access to healthcare or insurance or transportation, a lot of reasons for that. But in general, the patients that are presenting to us, even in outpatient areas, seem to be sicker and of higher acuity than even 30 years ago. This leads to office settings having sort of a mismatch or missing having the opportunity to have the right resources to match the possible emergency. And this is really consistent with what our experiences are at ISMP. Unfortunately, ambulatory clinics often don't think about the wide variety of emergencies that may be encountered in their office setting until after an emergency has occurred. This is a, gives leads me to an example that is probably one of the most poignant examples that I had from my private practice life. At the time when this occurred, providers were still leaving the office setting to attend to inpatients, as well as patients in their office. This doesn't happen as often because of the advent of hospital medicine, but the what occurred at this particular time was that over a lunch hour, one of the patients walked in with her mother having a pretty severe asthma attack, and the only people in the office at that time were our receptionists. So there was nobody there that could handle the emergency, and we hadn't set up any type of a schedule or call coverage for someone to return back to the office. We didn't even have a nurse in the office at that time. So, leading us to think about, okay, what might go wrong? Who's going to be present in your office when the providers leave? And oftentimes in this day and age, many offices have advanced practice providers, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, and sometimes they are left to cover the offices by themselves, even during patient hours. So who, what is, what's your schedule going to be to provide supervision if something happens? Who's going to need to return to the office? And like I say, that was a really poignant example for me of the things that we just didn't think about. So a huge concern is the things like the mismatch that occurs between what might happen and what you, what and who you have available to provide services to whatever that emergency is. So there's another thing that often happens in hospitals. We are pre-tuned in to the idea that we should standardize protocols wherever possible. Where there's a best practice, we should all be using it. And the best way to adhere to that is to have order sets or some type of standardized protocol. Well, in offices, we often do not think about that. The variety of people that are coming and going don't lend itself to the visit itself being standardized in that kind of way. But this is a gap where emergencies are concerned because we absolutely could standardize how we handle a respiratory emergency or how we handle a seizure or how we handle somebody in our office that's having chest pain, so that we have the right emergency equipment and the right medications and necessary anecdotes or rescue agents. So the other thing that happens quite frequently in offices is that there's limited oversight for the medication management process. So how do they order medicines? How do they stock them? How do they store them? How do they do the things that are basic to what occurs in hospital pharmacies? Offices very rarely have the advantage of having a pharmacist involved in this kind of thing. So there's often a lack of oversight around things like looking at expiration dates, for example. There's very rarely an organized approach to how you prepare medicines or how you administer emergency medicines. Storage, where do we store them? Office settings often are very limited in the amount of just simple storage space, cabinet space, closets, whatever it may be, refrigerator space. And so how we store medicines is often something that also does not have oversight. When we go into outpatient settings as ISMP doing consults, we will often see medicine stored in various locations. So you, even opening the refrigerator that holds all the lunches for the staff, will sometimes see a tray of vaccines sitting in there. So it's often limited by just what the office has available to it. But there's often also a very significant lack in how to use the medication. So how do you dilute them if you need to, for example? What kind of a syringe do you pull them up in? What's the needle length that you're supposed to be using? And these are all things that can definitely lead to having an emergency go bad, if you will, much more severely affecting a patient than you would otherwise expect them. The other thing that happens is that there's very, very often an unclear designation of responsibility. Is it the nurse? Is it the doc? who is it that's supposed to do what? For example, many offices have as part of their emergency response plan that they're going to call 911. Well, who does that?
Right.
Who's thought about whether it's the receptionist's responsibility to make that decision? Who tells the receptionist to do that? When does the receptionist do that? So these are the kinds of things that come up in offices that I think we often tend to forget to prioritize as we're going through the organizational structure of how an outpatient setting is set up.
So, those are a lot of things that I think, as you're describing them, they're the sort of the precursors to an adverse event or to a reaction. It could be as simple as a reaction, doesn't have to be an adverse event, right? But those are sort of the precursors to those emergencies. What are some things do that office practices and clinic type settings can do to make sure that they're set up to respond when emergencies do occur?
Yes, so you're right. Those are the precursors. And I think the idea of trying to figure out how to be more responsive to the emergencies that occur in your office is about taking a look at all of those things and trying to figure out how to mitigate the challenges that those offer you. Probably the most important point here is to remember that the choice of emergency medicines and equipment that are kept in your office should indeed reflect the variety of anticipated emergencies for that practice population. So, if I'm a pediatrician, I'm not as likely to prepare for adult chest pain, for example. But the other really big point is that the skills of the practitioners and staff need to be considered as well. No office should ever stock equipment that cannot be used safely by office staff, and that includes both the equipment, but as well the medications. So if there isn't training on how to use the things that you have in your office, you shouldn't have them. So another thing that along with that is, I think, a really big part of this is, how do you train your staff? How do you make sure that all staff that are appropriate are knowledgeable in the protocols that fit their skill set? So I talked about having the receptionist call 911. Well, okay, is it just as simple as calling 911, or is there somebody else that should be called as well? And how does the receptionist learn that? And how do all of the receptionists learn that? If the nursing staff, for example, is giving antibiotics or a medication, then how do we make sure that we've bridged the knowledge gaps so that the skill sets of those professionals match the things we're asking them to do? We just need to remember that the response to an emergency shouldn't be dependent upon a person. So it shouldn't be that Sally is the expert in giving, epinephrine in case of an allergic reaction. Everybody that sits in Sally's role, all of the people that are equivalent to Sally, need to understand how to perform that task. It shouldn't be person dependent. It should be dependent upon the role. So we have to figure out a way to bridge those knowledge gaps and get consistent training in the office. And I'll talk about one of the things that can be used in just a second, I think, as we get a little further along in this. But again, the office needs to be able to deliver the same level of care regardless of the schedule for who is working. This brings me back to my emergency example for when I was in practice. The office needs to be able to deliver the same level of care when it's open. If you're not able to deliver that level of care, like for lunch, then lock the door. So you need to kind of think about those kinds of things. The other thing that offices absolutely need to do to try to think through the list of things that I gave is to consider the distance to the nearest emergency room. If that's 45 minutes away in traffic, then you need to decide what's, for example, going to be the plan to get help to you before that patient can get to the emergency room. What's the response time for an average 911 call in your neighborhood? We all think about that in our homes, right? We think
Sure.
about what it means to live in a rural area, for example, and call 911, where it's very different, where you're living in a suburb where the fire station might be down the block. But if it's a long way to help, you've got to decide what you're going to do in the meantime. But a really key point here is to make sure that as you've thought about all of those things, develop a plan. So there should be a plan in your office to consider the variety of emergencies that are going to occur, and then consider all the things that might go wrong. if you were in a hospital setting or someplace where there's more formal training, this type of exercise would be called a failure modes effects analysis, where you would capture what might fail in your system and plan before you actually have to execute the plan on how to get around or fix those things that are going to fail. So you're proactively address those issues before they occur. This includes things like writing emergency protocols that outline the steps to be followed for whatever emergency you're talking about, designating staff and the roles and responsibilities. The other thing that has to happen is that if you're expecting your entire staff to be able to give CPR if it's needed, then you need to figure out how you're going to maintain current certification for all of your staff and have either basic or advanced life support courses that they are expected to attend, and figure out how you're going to reimburse staff for their time and their money. The other thing, as you know, big part of what we're talking about today is medication management. As I talked about, that's something that often falls by the wayside. So somebody needs to be assigned, whether that's a provider or a nurse or an office manager, even somebody needs to be assigned the medication management process so that there's a clear inventory and it matches the things that might occur. It's an inventory of not only medications, but the equipment. You know, for example, are you going to have a breathing machine for giving aerosol treatments to kids with asthmatics? You need to figure out how that person who is in charge of medication management is going to organize storage. And then it needs to be shared with everybody. Again, I'm amazed at the number of times that we go into settings like this doing consultations around medication management, where we find medications in various locations that the providers and the nursing staff didn't know were there. Well, they can't use the medicines if they don't know where they are. And so that certainly is a big piece of this. Another thing is to make sure that wherever that medication is stored, that it can e be easily transported around the department. If it's six syringes and a bunch of needles and the vials for medication, and you're juggling that in your hands, you know, that's not going to be conducive to making sure that it all gets where it needs to go. So what's your transport mechanism? Do you have a tackle box? Do you have a tray? What is it that you're going to use to transport? And then the other thing that we need to figure out is how to make the understandable resources about how to mix and administer the medications. That needs to be where we're going to use them. So maybe it needs to go with the medications as they arrive in an emergency. If they're taped to the back of the cabinet door, right?
Not going
Unless
with you.
you're taking the cabinet door off as your transport tray, right? Then that cabinet door is not helpful. And it is amazing the number of times that people just don't think about this kind of thing. So those, I think, are the things, you know, have a plan, get your people organized so that everybody's got a role, understand who's going to be in charge of ordering, keeping inventory stock, checking expiration dates, all of that kind of stuff, and make sure that wherever these are stored, it's shared with your staff.
You know, you use that example of the cabinet door, and that really brings to mind, you know, to me the question of how important are things like drills and simulation, and maybe not in the super high tech simulation way, but that sort of drill and role playing, does that help you discover those things sort of before you have an actual emergency and you can pause and say, oh yeah, no, I can't take the cabinet door with me. This needs to be on my tackle box or whatever it is.
It's a great segue. Thank you very much. Simulation is a huge asset. And it is often true that in settings like clinics, outpatient settings, we don't think about it, because when you think about simulation, you think about that high-tech center at the hospital. But you're absolutely right. It doesn't have to be high tech. Some of the best simulations that I have organized and run in my career were with little dolls that I got at Toys R Us. Well, you can't go to Toys R Us anymore because it doesn't exist. But, you know, the point being, it doesn't have to be high tech. And simulation-based education can really help in an area like office settings. Thankfully, the emergencies that we see in office settings are rare. They don't occur all the time. Well, we also know that knowledge base and skill sets that we all have erode over time. The best analogy I can think of that is so funny, right? We all rode a bike as kids, and everybody says you never forget to ride a bike. Well, those of us that are my age, and I'm old, right? The first time I got on a bike after, 30 years of not riding a bike, I will tell you that that skill set did not immediately come back. That was scary. And in office settings, things like how do you use the equipment that you have? How do you administer epinephrine? If you don't do that but once every 2 or 3 years, it's not a skill you're going to be comfortable with. And simulation really helps this kind of thing a lot. Simulation is actually one of ECRI's top 10 patient safety concerns for 2024 as a way to help practitioners, especially newly trained practitioners, develop critical interpersonal skills and practice as well. Because the other thing that simulation really brings out is communication gaps. It really brings to the forefront where people say out loud in the debriefs, "Well, I was thinking about it." Well, if you were thinking about it, unless you thought about it out loud, the people standing next to you didn't know it was happening. So simulation is a huge can be a huge asset here. It is the way to sort of help that failure mode effects analysis, that process of trying to decide what's going to go wrong and trying to mitigate it before it actually happens, and should be done regularly, so that there's ongoing safety competency assessments through the use of simulation that can be something that everybody does once a year, twice a year, those kinds of things. The other thing that I think really helps is for folks to have some sort of basic patient safety training as a core element. Lots of people just don't understand that this kind of stuff is really a part of what we do in healthcare and should be part of our training.
One of the things we hear a lot, especially in the outpatient setting, when we talk about things like drilling and training, is sort of an acknowledgement that it's important. But then the next response is, "But gosh, we don't have the time. We're already so packed. Like as you said, we're sort of churning through all these patients. How on earth can we possibly make non-patient care time available to do this?" Have you ever sort of worked with an organization to help them make that time, so to speak?
Yeah, I think your comment is very apropos, and I don't think necessarily that it changes all that much over the years. Certainly when I was in private practice, we're all intimately aware of the fact that the number of patients coming through the door is what's keeping us afloat. And that's not going to be different. It isn't it, pre and post COVID, it isn't hasn't changed. But I think that's part of my comment around making patient safety training a part of the core understanding of our professionals as they go through their nursing courses, physician medical schools, residencies. People just are not aware of the fact that patient safety is what's considered to be a soft dollar, right? So what that means is that the time spent trying to figure out how to avoid a crisis also helps you try to avoid the downstream consequences of the crisis, which often is expensive, right? And so having an understanding of the fact that if how we do anything is how we do everything. So if we can figure out how to do the things that we do over the course of our day in a safer way, it actually makes for better outcomes, makes for more patients who want to come to that practice. But those are soft. So you have to figure out how to make that case that an hour or two well spent doing things like medication management, simulation training, running the drills in your office is time well spent to be prepared when the crisis occurs and have a good outcome. And the good outcome is what you want. So at the end of the day, the outcome should help you justify that extra time spent away from patient care.
Are there any other steps that, staffs in the clinics and physician offices can take that you wanted to touch on?
Nothing that I can think of that I haven't mentioned. I think that, like I say, the biggest point to remember is that each setting is different, and each setting has to consider what's likely to occur in that setting, and they're different. Even in an office building where there are multiple offices, what might happen in the X-ray office is very different than what might happen in a cardiologist's office or a surgeon's office or a pediatrician's office. So everybody has to think about what it is that might happen in their offices, but to then remember that you shouldn't be stocking anything, medications or equipment, that your staff can't use. And if you remember, like I said, that thankfully emergencies are rare, then you gotta figure out a way for the staff to be competent to use that equipment in the rare setting that it's needed. And that's where the things like simulation and really convincing leadership that taking the time away to do this is important. Because again, it's all about trying to figure out how to have the best outcome that you can.
All right, Dr. Schultz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
To see more medication safety guidance from the Institute for Safe Medication Practices, be sure to visit ismp.org. Be sure to subscribe to Smart Healthcare Safety on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you get our latest episodes. We welcome your feedback. Please visit us at ecri.org or email us at ecri-podcasts@ecri.org.